everybody. Welcome to Drive Through HR. Happy Tuesday. And it's Brian and Misha today. And William will be back tomorrow. And we've got a great guest. Can't wait to kick it off. Misha, I hope you had a good Monday and Tuesday's going well for you.
Yes, it is.
Well, fantastic. That is exactly the answer I wanted to hear. Let's get to our guest. It's one of my favorite guests because he actually, for some reason, makes me laugh more than some of our guests make me chuckle. And he just cracks me up. So I mean,
and you can't even see me, which is the best part. So
yeah, I don't know if it's the Philly. I don't know if it's the Cleveland. I can't put my finger on it. I guess maybe I don't need to. So, John Hyman, welcome back to Drive Through HR.
It is fabulous to be back.
So, we're good. Why don't we get all crazy and kick it off the same way we have done for 600 other times? Why don't you introduce yourself to our millions of listeners, and then we'll roll into what's top of mind for you.
Yeah, my name is John Hyman. I am an employment lawyer living and practicing in cloudy, snowy, cold Cleveland, Ohio. My practice is almost exclusively management side labor and employment law, half litigation, half what I call being an outside in-house counsel to companies, advising companies on day-to-day HR and labor and employment issues. And then in addition to my busy law practice, I am also a busy blogger on my blog 5 days a week, the Ohio Employers Law Blog. And you can find me in other social media channels as well, talking, commenting on various HR, labor and employment related issues.
Yeah, and you kick some serious employment law opinion ass over there, I might add.
Well, I appreciate that. That's the goal, right? You got to be a little opinionated, a little provocative to get an audience. So,
well, and that's and you've got a. We've been very fortunate to probably have the biggest. We probably have the greatest portfolio of employment law attorneys with the best personalities and provocative. Kind of sense of humor of anywhere in the country, all on Drive Through HR. So I think we are the linchpin for that movement, I might add.
You are what's making the slightly off-center employment law world go round.
Yeah, I mean, no grandiose. I'm not bringing any grandiose to the show today at all. I'm speaking the truth. So
much appreciated.
Speaking of truth, what's top of mind today specifically with you?
You know, what's been keeping me up at night lately is unnecessary laws that aren't needed and don't make sense. And here's what I'm talking about. So there is a couple weeks ago, and I'm going to talk for Ohio a second because that's where I am, but it really applies across the country. In the Ohio legislature a couple weeks ago, seven Democrats got together and introduced a bill that would make it illegal for employers to require job applicants to turn over or employees to turn over passwords to their social media and other online accounts. And so Ohio, there's six states right now, California, Michigan, Illinois, Maryland, and I'm missing a couple, that have already passed laws like this, and there's 25 or 28 or 30 others that have similar legislation that's pending. And I guess what's keeping me up at night is, why are we wasting our time in our government passing laws that are not addressing problems that need to be addressed? I mean, I've been doing this employment law thing now for 16 years. I threw both my kind of on-the-feet career and my online career. I have a network of companies, businesses, clients, lawyers, what have you, that I talk to all over the country, and I don't know of a single one. I don't know of a single company that's doing this. I don't know of a single company out there that's saying to employees or job applicants, you know, we're going to fire you or we're not going to hire you if you don't, if you refuse to give us your password or you won't let us kind of stand over your shoulder and kind of look at your Facebook page while you're logged into your account. It's just not, it's not a problem that I don't think we should be, you know, wasting whatever scarce government resources we have, you know, especially in 2013 when we have much bigger fish to fry legislatively, both in the various states and at the federal level. Why we're wasting our time and resources dealing with problems that, if they exist, are very, very small, and I doubt exist at all.
Well, and I want to get funny you bring this up. So I was having coffee with a friend of mine in Dallas, who's a long time XPR practitioner, and has, you know, basically does designs training and for fairly large companies, but also does some of the real tactical employee handbook reviews and the writing of employee handbooks and everything. And she made probably one of the most interesting statements that I'd ever actually heard, was that HR tends to be, the whole design of the human resource practice is to manage exceptions. And the employee handbook, all that is a aggregate, it's just a, we put together a list of exceptions. Because the majority of people just use common sense and actually just come in and do a good job every day. That is the book of exceptions that we then try and ultimately, whatever happened at one point in time, now we base all of our management around this book of exceptions versus going the other way like you're talking about. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I think that's exactly right. I mean, when I... To use your example of the employee handbook, I mean, when I write a lot of handbooks in my practice, I review a lot of handbooks, and so what I try to do is kind of set a baseline of expectations as to how kind of the parties are going to manage their relationship. But I think you're right. A lot of that kind of expectational management is, you know, is planning for the exception, because 99 out of 100 or, you know, 99.9 out of 100 of your employees aren't going to sexually harass, aren't going to steal, aren't going to be excessively tardy or excessively late, aren't going to be insubordinate. They're going to be your, like my job, happy to have a job, enjoy my paycheck every 2 weeks, like the people I work with, like what I do, come in, do my straight eight or whatever it takes to get the job done, and go home and have dinner with my wife and kids and then come back the next day and do it all over again. And I think you're right. I think what we are doing is, whether it's, you know, drafting handbooks or contracts or whatever, to manage for the exception so that there's not any disagreement when the outlier pops up as to how management's going to handle it and what that outlier's expectations are going to be as to how it's handled, or if we're drafting legislation to handle the outlier. And I guess my question is, it's all well and good in a private company to put some resources into getting a handbook in place because, number one, I mean, the law in a lot of regards says you have to have it. I mean, if you're 50 or more employees, the FMLA says you have to have an FMLA provision in your handbook. So you have to have a handbook to have the provision. You have to have a harassment policy if you want to take advantage of certain affirmative defenses in a sexual or other harassment lawsuit. And so there's good policy reasons to have a handbook. I'm not sure the same policy reasons carry over, though, when we are using government resources to spend our time drafting legislation, especially when you can look around the country and see problems that are not being addressed in our legislatures. I mean, I think this is going to sound weird coming from a management side advocate, but I think there is a glaring hole that our legislature needs to address in Title VII, and that is discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. I just, before I hopped on the show today, came across a recent case from an Ohio appellate court that was just decided a couple weeks ago that threw a case out where the employee said I was harassed because of my sexual orientation, and the court said sex and sexual orientation aren't the same. The law doesn't protect sexual orientation as a protected class, and therefore, employee, you're out on your ear. And you know, it's difficult for me, even though I'm an advocate for employers, and I don't like to see more laws piled on top of the laws we already have to make things more difficult for employers. But conceptually, it's difficult for me in 2013 in a free and open country to understand why there is still a classification of people that it is perfectly okay to discriminate against. And you can fire, with some small exceptions for some cities and that provide that this is illegal, but kind of broad-based across the country, it's okay to say, you know, I'm firing you because I don't want any homosexuals working in my business. I have a hard time. And I mean, I would thought we got past all that back in the 60s, and I understand that race and sexual orientation and all that are different animals, but it just so if we're going to talk about kind of how we spend our legislative resources to get things done that should matter to the country, I think there's much, much deeper issues to deal with than whether or not a hypothetical employer could potentially ask a hypothetical job applicant to turn over a password to their Facebook account. We can talk about kind of what legislature should be doing, whether it's more time off for parents, or whether we need paid time off for employees, or other how government should be directing their resources, and time being one of the key ones. But I just don't think the social media issue is one that really needs a whole lot of time spent talking about it, because I just don't see it as a problem.
Yeah, I absolutely, and I'm glad you bring that up, because that's one of those things that people, I think it's definitely a very uncomfortable conversation for people, because it brings all of a sudden you right to the top, people where they're pretty good most of the time, all of a sudden have a bunch of their religious beliefs right in front of them that they want to bring up. And like, well, I just don't philosophically agree with this. Right, or theologically agree with it, or whatever the case may be, like around, you know, basically Title 7 work, right? I totally agree. I mean, I think I just cannot believe that this is such a gigantic issue. I just have a hard time from an intellectual standpoint, not to mention it just, you know, it just is heartbreaking that we would just say, no, it's still all right. Even if we don't talk about it, it's still all right to make these, you know, total value judgments here and say we're going to discriminate because that's not the kind of person we feel would be good for our company. You know what I mean? Relative to, you know, doing all the work that we do, like selling and manufacturing and possibly administrative, I just can't believe, and with, you know, and you just hear this from companies that
we don't want. That kind of person working here, which, by the way, is the same thing that people said back in, you know, Alabama or Mississippi back in the 1950s about African Americans. It's no different.
It is no different at all. That's why it hurts my head. It hurts my head and my heart, quite frankly, because I just don't understand. I don't understand how you could, you know, you literally could be so, you know, so you can't see the parallels to draw in that, right? That people just, they feel not valued. It just doesn't make any sense, and it's not fair. So, but it's still a gigantic issue. I mean, with all the marriage legislation, I mean, the undertones are all there, right? But it's one of those that just gets avoided. And we, luckily in Tulsa, we actually have a couple of companies that have definitely been on the front end of kind of the diversity and inclusion, just the things that they do around giving equal benefits to partners, as well as, you know, basically the traditional, quote-unquote, husband and wife marriage type scenarios. And they're big companies, thank goodness. So they get more press than most. So that actually helps. So I really appreciate you bringing that up, because I don't think it's talked about. even enough, even remotely.
You know, you talked earlier about employee handbooks, and one thing I do whenever I draft a handbook or review a handbook for a company is put that in, or at least in a first draft, until a company says that's not our values, we don't want it, and then I have a conversation with them as to why and what values are you really trying to push on your employees. But I always write sexual orientation into an EEO policy in a handbook because I think it sends the right message to the employees that we are a workplace of inclusion, not exclusion. And we don't care whether you're, you know, white, purple, brown, green, in a wheelchair, 75 years old, or happen to live with a man if you're a man. I mean, I think it sends the right message to your workers that we value diversity, whatever that diversity is. And I think by cutting that piece out just because the law says, well, we don't have to protect sexual orientation, I think you are sending the message that we are a company that doesn't value diversity as much as we should, because we are not willing to accept people no matter who they are or no matter what core beliefs or core values or particular traits they bring to the table. And I just think that sends a horrible message to all of a company's employees.
Well, great. I'm going to do a quick reset, everybody. This is Nisha and Brian talking to our wonderful guest, Jonathan Heyman. Hey, John, I have a question going back to our employee handbook. You know, policies are good when it's on papers. But, you know, when we talk about employee handbook, what are some complications when employers don't pull them off the shelf and update it?
Yeah, well, it's a big risk for companies. I mean, one thing I see often from companies is either they don't pull them off the shelf and update them, or when they draft the handbook, they just – I mean, look, the Internet's a great resource. We're talking to everybody through the Internet. I love the Internet. But in terms of putting policies in place for your business, the Internet can be a really dangerous thing, because you can go – you know, you can Google form employee handbook and you can get, you know, 15,000 example employee handbooks to use for your business. And you don't know who drafted them, when they drafted them, what state they were drafted in, what state they were drafted for, whether a lawyer ever looked at it or vetted it. When the last time it was reviewed, was it written in 1991 or was it written in 2012 or 2013? Because laws change. There are different laws in different states that will greatly implicate what policies you have to have in your handbook. There are, you know, for example, some states have what are called off-duty conduct laws, where it's illegal to take an employment action against someone because of something they do legally off-duty. So smoking, for example, is a great example. So there's a lot of states that have laws that prohibit discrimination against smoking, either smoking on its face, you can't discriminate against smokers, or smoking because it's a lawful activity that someone is doing outside the workplace. But your state might not have those laws. But if you are just pulling something off the shelf or pulling something off the Internet and putting it in without any thought or without any review by someone who understands the legal issues that are in the handbook, you're making a commitment for your company that that's going to be the policy of your company without really any understanding as to why you're making that commitment. Or, you know, another great example is, you know, I can't tell you, you know, how many companies – small companies have FMLA policies in their handbook. Why do they have them? They can't tell you. They'll tell you, well, that's, we thought we needed it, or we pulled something off the Internet and it was an FMLA policy. Well, now they've, even if they're only a company with 12 or 13 employees, they've now bound themselves to follow the FMLA, because courts are going to say, if you tell employees we follow the FMLA, whether you're big enough to be covered by it or not, guess what? You got to follow the FMLA. And if you don't follow the FMLA and you fire someone who goes to take an unpaid leave of absence, but you have a policy that says we're going to give you 12 weeks and you don't, you're probably going to be in a little bit of legal trouble. So there's, you know, laws change, new laws get passed, and if you are not, you know, as a matter of best practice, I mean, handbooks really should be pulled off the shelf, dusted off, and reviewed, you know, once in every 12-month cycle. I know that, in most companies that doesn't happen. But really, as a matter of best practice, once every 12 months to look at a handbook will, you know, capture whatever legal or policy changes there are. It also, you know, time sometimes gives you some good perspective, and a policy that seemed like a good idea, even if it's still perfectly legal and perfectly fine, a policy statement that seemed like a good idea last year, all of a sudden might no longer fit your business or fit your, you know, or fit your, you know, what expectations you want to set for your relationship with your employees. So, you know, every 12 months, not a bad idea to pull the handbook off the shelf, give it the once over, call your employment lawyer, say, hey, do you mind taking a look at this and telling us if anything's changed or anything you think we should be doing differently, is a pretty good business practice and will save you a lot of trouble down the road.
Wonderful. So now we have everything on papers right now, like employee handbook, policies, everything is ready. But when it comes to communicating that to employees and back and forth from employee to employer and from employer to employer, so how can employers get employees more, you know, come forward with complaints or grievances or communicating more open manner?
Yeah, you know, it's really a culture thing. It's a question of what is your corporate culture like? Do you, and that starts at the top, number one, in terms of, you know, do your employees feel comfortable, you know, raising issues? Do you, when employees complain, are their complaints taken seriously? Are they investigated? Are they addressed? Are employees retaliated against when they raise issues or make complaints? I mean, how you address issues that employees have, address complaints, whether they're kind of big C complaints like I'm being discriminated against or I'm being sexually harassed, or little C complaints like the light's no good, it's hard for me to see to do my job, I need a better light, or geez, I like Pepsi, not Coke. Do you think we can get more Pepsi in the soda machine in the break room? How you address all of those complaints, and even the littlest complaints, goes a long way to setting the culture as the corporate culture as to how complaints are handled overall. And you want to create an environment where employees feel comfortable, you know, going to HR, going to management, going all the way up, you know, depending on your company, to the, you know, to the president, to the CEO, to whomever is you know, at the top, if they're accessible, so that employees know that if there is an issue, it will be addressed. So that when the big issues come up, the big C complaints, the harassment, the discrimination, the unfair wage practices, the you know, whatever violation of law an employee thinks is taking place, that employee, A, knows that there is someone to whom they can complain, B, knows the complaint will be taken seriously, and C, knows that nothing will happen to them as a result of filing that complaint. All of which will, and look, the more open it is, the more complaints you're going to get, but the better you address and handle the complaints from a kind of a litigation avoidance best practices standpoint, you're going to be in a great position. If somebody comes to you and says, we don't, you know, my complaint wasn't taken seriously, I was retaliated against, nothing was done, the better history you have addressing, handling, documenting, addressing, not retaliating, all of these things, it's gonna put you in a much better position to defend against that, as we were talking about earlier, these outliers, these people that don't fall within the norm of how we expect our employees to react. If it's an outlier from how our business responds to these issues, you're going to be in a much better position to go and defend against this. Go and defend against this outlier claim.
So, what's great information, by the way. So, let's talk about email. One of the tweets you had earlier around email and privacy, and it's kind of expand on maybe some recent cases or just some good best, you know, just some thoughts around if you're an employer or an employee, kind of what's the relationship on email?
Yeah, well, it it's going to depend on, number one, whose email it is. Is it the company's email or the employee's email? If it's the company's email, I think it's, in other words, you are using your company's, you know, your corporate domain, your company email address. It's, you should probably, as an employee, assume that you don't have any expectation of privacy in what's being transmitted through that email system. The company owns it. It's theirs. It's not yours. And I think it's naive for employees to believe that, you know, if I, you know, if I work for Walmart and I send an email through my, you know, jdoe@walmart email address, that somehow that's, that the company has no right to see what's in that email.
Right.
You know, there are, from, again, as we talk about managing expectations, because you will have the outlier employee who's going to say, well, I didn't understand that even though it's a, you know, a company email account, that I could I thought it was private. Why does the company have a right to snoop in, you know, in my email even though they own it? And I guarantee you there's employees out there that think that way. That it's for that reason, again, to manage the outliers. It's a good idea to put a policy down on paper to manage the expectations at the outset of the relationship, so there is no disagreement down the road when you have to look in someone's email as part of an investigation. Too, I mean, look, employers, they don't have the time or resources, and frankly, don't care to read every email that goes through their servers. And if they cared, they wouldn't be able to do it anyway. But there are instances when they have to, like when someone complains of harassment and a company has to go in and do an investigation to figure out what's going on, they have to go look through the emails when there's litigation. Better to set the expectations up front so there is no disagreement down the road as to who owns it and what the privacy expectations are. Now, if it's an employee's private email account, so if it's, you know, John Doe's Gmail account that he happens to access through his workplace computer, there is a federal statute called the Stored Communications Act, which is basically, it's like wiretapping for emails. That is likely going to make it illegal for an employer to, you know, intercept personal emails, go into someone's personal email accounts, even if those emails are being transmitted through a company server. There's some exceptions. You can get consent of the employee, and so maybe you can have an employee sign off and say, "I give you permission to, and I give up my privacy rights and give you permission to look at what goes through your server." But it's really a legal minefield, and so the best practice, really, because a lot of these issues remain kind of evolving and unsettled legally, the best practice really is, if it's an employee's personal email account, their Gmail, their Outlook.com, their Yahoo, AOL, whatever, if anybody still has AOL accounts, the best practice really is just to leave it alone. And the real privacy line is drawn on a corporate email accounts.
Perfect. Well, hey,
I realize I just insulted your entire audience, anyone in your audience who has an AOL account, so be it.
Well, you know what? There's probably only like two of them, so we'll deal with the complaints as they come in. So there's just some things that just get on Gmail. Come on, people. What are we doing here? So we got about 60 seconds left. Absolutely great conversation, John and Nisha. Let's definitely. How can people find you? And then we're gonna roll on out with some fantastic music.
Yeah, I'm not hard to find. You can find me on my blog, OhioEmployerLawBlog.com. You can find me on my firm's website, KJK.com. You can find me on Twitter at John Hyman. That's JONHYMAN. A couple of quick plugs. People are interested in more what I have to say. My book, The Employer Bill of Rights, is available on Amazon. You can search for Employer Bill of Rights, or you can search for my name, John Hyman. Going back to our conversation about social media passwords, I'm running a poll online. I kind of want to see what people's what the experiences are out in the business world to see if they match what my perceptions of them are. And so if you're interested, I'm running it for another couple weeks. It's tinyurl.com /social media passwords if any of your listeners want to take a quick kind of one-minute survey to let me know what their experiences are with asking employees or job applicants for what their social media and other online logins and passwords. So
that is fantastic. We're out of here, folks.
One,
have a good day.
Two,
thanks, guys.
One.